on the island to the Sunset Strip. Somebody's gonna make a happy trip tonight while the moon is bright. He's gonna have a bag of crazy toys to give the cronies of the girls and boys all day. Santa comes on day. Come a calling when the snow's the most, when all your cats are sleeping warm as toast, and you can flip with old Saint Nick, place a lick on a peppermint stick. You come a flying from a higher place, fill the stocking by the fireplace, so you have a youth that's
welcome, 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 welcome back. Happy 2010. We're glad you are here with us for a brand new year on the Pirate Monk podcast from Pirate Monk Radio and SamsonSociety.org. Hi, Nate. How you doing?
Hi, David. I'm doing great.
I'm doing great, too.
Glad to be alive at the turning of another year.
As my old mentor used to say, one more day on this side of the grave. And we're here, myself, David Mullen, Nate Larkin, and our fearless engineer, Mondo. And we're just getting back from the New Year's. What'd you do for New Year's, anyway?
New Year's. I brought in the New Year's in my new hot tub. The hot tub. Yes.
Hot tub. Come back. Wow.
That's you.
It was great. It showed up. It showed up on Christmas Eve. Dropped it in my driveway.
How do I not know about this?
Well, I have been keeping it secret from you.
Yeah, well, I guess you have.
The thing weighs 1,000 pounds.
1,000 pounds.
And has 80 jets of power.
80 jets of power.
Yeah, it took 10 guys to carry it from my driveway and set it on the pad that we poured for
it. Wow, what do you run that thing on, a nuclear reactor or something?
Yeah, I shudder to think what my electric bill is going to be.
So you've been using it.
Well, the mistake I made, the plan was I wanted to be in it. I wanted to bring in the new year, Allie and me sitting in the hot tub. And everything went perfect. The problem was I got in it at about 8 o'clock on New Year's Eve.
Oh.
I was asleep by 9:30.
Oh, there you go. You didn't even see the new year.
Did not. Just.
Well, it's midnight somewhere.
It wore me out, yeah. But it was great.
That is hilarious. So
what'd you do for the
new
year?
When do I get to use the hot tub?
Anytime, my friend.
What are you afraid I'm going to, like, I don't know what, urinate it or something?
I don't have chemicals yet.
Okay. Well, yeah, I had a similar experience, yet completely different. And you have to know, like, right now, like, it's just hard imagining people in a hot tub. It is, when I got up at the farm this morning, it was 8 degrees.
It's terrifying.
And that's pretty cold for Tennessee, just so y'all know. But we didn't have a lot of people in this year. Normally we travel a lot, like we're in England a lot for the holidays. Mondo's actually gone over with us a couple of times, and we stay through Boxing Day and play concerts and speak to people through New Year's. Usually New Year's is the big bash, you know, and it'll either be at Royal Albert Hall or there's a big church there, a Nigerian church that broadcasts all over the world, and a lot of times we go there. And then it's wonderful because it just feels like Christmas, looks like Christmas, and we go out to Oxford and that sort of thing. And if we don't do that, then normally we would be home and all the kids from the extended family would come in, my sisters and
that crowd I met at Thanksgiving.
That's right, that crowd at Thanksgiving. And because my mom and dad live out with us, we built them a home, and my in-laws, we built them a home, and my grandparents are even here. And so everybody just comes to us because there's plenty of room and it's very, you know, central to everybody. So, but this year, we did that for Thanksgiving because it was my parents' 50th anniversary. So, as you well know, because you were there and part of that, and so we just had just me, my wife, and the kids. And we had, I can't remember, like, when we've ever done that. So Christmas was like that, and then New Year's was like that. And we stayed up, and my daughter, Jazz, she had never seen the ball drop
in
Times Square.
Yeah.
And so we watched New Year's Rockin' Eve with Dick Clark.
Is he back?
Well, man, I don't know. If any of y'all saw that, I don't know how back you would call it, but he was there. I was like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And
he's a stroke survivor, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And
the fact that he was there is just phenomenal.
And that he was speaking like he was announcing and stuff, which you could barely understand him and stuff. But he still looked young even then. Like, it was crazy.
Yeah.
And
they take him out of the formaldehyde.
Yeah.
On New Year's
they
Eve.
They take out of the cryogenic solution once a year to do the New Year's Rockin' Eve. And, of course, Ryan Seacrest was the other guy. And so we sat there and watched that and played this new game called Quarkle, which is sort of a cross between Scrabble and Dominoes. And, just that was it. I mean, and I was just like, this is my life now. really.
And it is good.
It is good. I mean, that's exactly what I thought, actually. I mean, I've been thinking, you know, literally have had New Year's Eve with heads of state and kings and queens and crazy stuff, you know, and Hollywood stars and this sort of thing. But really just being home with your family. And it wasn't like some big moment, but it was just like, this is actually... I'm really glad I'm here. I'm sober.
Nice.
With my family. And it was
life
good.
Is good.
And life is good, yeah. Yeah, it really was. You know, New Year's resolutions, always a good time of year to start, you know. It just seems like a brand new start for a lot of people.
Yeah.
What are you going to do the same this year? That you've done in the past that you think is good practice for you.
Yeah. Well, I actually want to talk about some of that stuff a little later in the podcast. I want to continue the daily disciplines of prayer, study, and self examination. The basic stuff, the peddling that I've found is necessary to keep me sober.
Right.
And it's no small resolution just to resolve to continue to do those things. There's always an urge to slack off, to coast. And so I want to remember to keep pedaling this year.
Yeah.
And
what would you do differently?
Different. Well, I'll tell you what. Toward the end of this year, I allowed myself to slack off on physical care, specifically going to the gym.
Like what they call radical self-care.
A little radical. I wasn't too radical in my self-care toward the end of the year. I was taking care of business and not taking care of myself. So I probably, I will join the throngs at the health club in January. It's always busiest in January because everybody's made their resolutions. It thins out around Valentine's Day. Yeah.
Right.
But I shall join the throngs and try to keep up with that. What about you?
I'm kind of in the same, mode. I really want to get away from... I think I have gotten away from, let me say it that way, some of the more just bedrock disciplines that you need to have. I mean, I read scripture, but I don't meditate on the scripture. And really, that's what gets me personally. I don't know about other people, but like, I can go through my daily Bible reading like any old man and just like have it on my checklist. Check, I have read the Bible today, you know, and I've done it for 25 years, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it got inside of me and it changed my heart, you know. And usually that means like being quiet and being still. And even if it's for, you know, that half hour out of the day, it's hard to sit for a half hour and just think. And knowing you have all these distractions that want to pull at you from work to home and family to church and ministries and different things that you're supposed to be doing all throughout the week and the day. And I really want to get back to that, those are the things I want to do. The same, the thing I would do differently is that I would like give it a little more time to for meditative reflectiveness.
Yeah.
And actually, in my self care, I've actually done pretty well. You know, I've gotten back into, those of you who don't know, I'm an old football player, so I can't really run or do anything anymore. My knees are gone. But just, you know, being able to walk every day and, yeah. and to lift weights all the time and just make sure I'm...
What are these weights of which you speak?
What are they? Oh, you don't. Yeah, you don't know, do you?
Do.
Yeah, but for me, like, I'm a big dude and just... Really, the endorphins that come from all that make me feel like I can handle so much more. It's just amazing how that little bit of, and it's, you know, it's an hour, you know, every other day, you know what
right.
I mean? And I usually spend it with my two boys, you know?
Sure.
So it's a real easy time and just that little bit of self-care makes me feel like it can handle so much more things that just the hour before seemed overwhelming.
Right.
You know, and I think that that's why they push it so much in recovery type programs.
Yeah.
So that's what we're going to be speaking about a little bit today. We'd like to, you know, New Year's is a good time to just like go full force into your addiction too. So some of you are like jumping right in with a gusto and we
you
want
was that new computer.
That's right. So today's topic is going to be relapse and how we deal with it right here on the Pirate Monk Podcast. We're back at the Pirate Monk Podcast, and as always, we are in the letters section of the program. Nate, did you get any letters over the holidays?
Well, the mailbag wasn't full.
Yeah, we're going to have to fix that, people.
I know. We're going to have to start offering, signed copies of Samson and the Pirate
or something.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to write us, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a question, if you have a problem, if you have something you want us to address on the show, or just want to just communicate with us, you can reach us at Samson...
Letters.
Oh, letters. Letters at SamsonSociety.org. So anyway, you...
I did get a great letter, though, from Ocala, Florida.
Oh, Lord.
Ocala. You don't know Ocala, Florida, do you?
I know it a little bit. I was not born there, but I was raised there. Moved there when I was a really young kid. And moved away when I was 21.
Oh.
And I went to Fort King Middle School and Vanguard High School.
Nice.
And then, I lived over there on Northeast 11th Street, just down the road from Fort King, as a matter of fact. Thank you for asking.
And I have no idea what you're talking about.
Exactly.
But I do love Ocala, Florida. What a pretty town.
It's a beautiful town. It's used to be orange groves at mm-hmm. the turn of the last century, and then they had those episodes of freezing and canker right. in the 70s and 80s, and it kind of just slowly killed off the orange crop. But because of the types of rolling hills that mm-hmm. they had, it ended up being used for horse pasture, and then so the horse industry moved in, and the thoroughbred horse industry is the big cash cow there, so to speak. And of course, wherever you have horse racing and horses, you have lots and lots of drug money.
Yeah.
It's an easy way to launder money. And so, therefore, thus the problems inherent in my lifestyle before I came to know the Lord. So, you know, all in all, a really, really great town, a lot of great people.
And there is now a Samson Society meeting in Ocala, Florida.
Really?
There is. I know there is because Mike from Ocala has written to us.
What did he have to say?
Well, he says, I'm not going to read the whole letter. I appreciate he sent us a nice, long letter. I'll read pieces of it. Hey, guys, I freaking love the podcasts. Took me a few times to start the first one, only because they're so long. But now I'm always checking to see if there are any new ones. I really appreciate what you guys are putting into this thing. He says, the Pirate Monks of Ocala were having some issues and stuff that we had a separate meeting about one night. And one thing that I think really helped us, Nate, was when you said the groups that struggle are the ones that put too much emphasis on the meetings. Mm. That was powerful for us. We have been meeting for over a year, and I think we're somewhat over a hump. We really need to do a 48 hours of frankness, but that's still on the drawing board. Anyway, we have been reminded that we've got to be in relationship, actively, and that takes constant work. The devil would never let something like that happen easily. He writes, so cool to hear that Andy Gullihorn is a pirate monk. I wish you guys would have had him play The Beginning of the End. For me, that song represents some of the first steps that every Samsonite takes. Mm. One last thing. Our group is starting a new tradition called the Pyro Monks Christmas Tree Burning.
There you go.
Next Monday, for our after meeting, we're going to invite all the guys to bring their old Christmas trees. We're going to light them up and roast some dogs together around the fire after the blaze subsides. Since we're doing the fire right near our meeting location, we're hoping this will be a chance for some of our guys who never get the chance to go to the after meeting to stick around for a few minutes of fellowship outside the meeting. That's all for now. Please continue your good work. The group, your story, and boldness has changed my life. Thank you, Mike. And just for you, we're going to send out The Beginning of the End by Andy Gullihorn.
Just a few hours left, it could have been worse. At least it's all out on the table here between. Now who I really am, and who you thought I was. Yeah, there's freedom, but the taste is bittersweet when you're hungry. Truth comes like a thief when the ceiling caves in. Such a sweet relief, the beginning of the end. You have to tear it apart, get the pieces to mend. Strange place to start. Get it all out. Take whatever you need to muster up the strength to look me in the eye and dig deep down far enough into the fire to find the place where we started. Do you remember? Comes like a thief when the ceiling caves in. Such a sweet relief, the beginning of the end. You have to tear it apart, get the pieces to mend. Strange place to start.
Hey, Nate. Anybody ask you about Tiger Woods?
Oh, wow.
I know. I mean, it's like, we're like, you know, that's sort of a joke because we walk around town and people will always say, oh, hey, I have this friend or, you know, I have this problem or blah, blah, blah. And Nate is like the poster child for sex addiction, I guess. So.
At least in this part of the woods.
Yeah, in this part of the woods. So people are always asking him about just obscure people. So I'm sure every other person must have asked you.
Oh, I get asked about Tiger Woods all the time.
Mm.
I tell you what, a friend of mine, Ed Shin, sent me a link to a column by a guy who I think addressed it better than I could.
Okay.
He's a sports columnist for the Washington Post, a guy named Mike Wise.
Okay.
And in fact, what I want to do, I want to read excerpts from the column. I thought it was beautiful. This is Mike Wise. I am Tiger Woods. Weeks after the personal life of the world's most recognizable athlete crumbled, I still cringe every time I hear a voicemail of a desperate man trying to hide the truth from his significant other. The reason I have yet to write about the biggest sports story of the year in these pages is because Woods's plea is to one of his many mistresses brought up old, awful feelings of shame, guilt, and humiliation.
Mm.
I won't revisit my own crash site in any detail here, but I can say the painful first step of the journey of seeing myself for who I really was also began in the worst imaginable way. I am Tiger Woods. And just as Charles Barkley stood up for him during his weakest moments, I had friends lend support, telling others not to judge. And while their efforts were appreciated, most of these people turned out to be enablers from the fraternity of arrested development, where boys must be boys because authentic men aren't allowed to join. Mm. I knew I couldn't change until my circle of friends changed.
Mm.
I am Tiger Woods.
Mm.
And saying the greatest golfer on the planet got married too young is a cheap cop-out that misses an essential point, that this is really about a man who has everything and nothing at the same time, a guy medicating with women to fill emotional gaps, the way some people use food, alcohol, drugs, work, or golf on television. I am Tiger Woods. And I understand why the scent of a woman is unbeaten in 2009 and beyond. It's an equal opportunity addiction, costing manicured, polished stars such as Rick Pitino their coiffed reputations, and unknown, dumpy software salesmen their families and their jobs. Mm. The truth is, I need help not to be Tiger Woods. A support system, helpful to this day. When the world's most recognizable athlete uses his BlackBerry to text a relative kid in Las Vegas about how much he misses her, and she's but one of a dozen, that's not sex. That's sickness. I am Tiger Woods. And I have poked fun at his travails because I use humor as camouflage. Because if I were to deal with the truth, if the world were to know the details of my sad, pathetic electronic communication with other women at one time in my life, the horrific embarrassment would not just send me into seclusion, it would send me off the ledge.
Mm.
It's easy, maybe even natural, to judge his actions and ignore what led to them. Tiger Woods has an emotional void in his life. This void must be huge. For him to be where he is today, this deep emptiness must have consumed him, must be something he's been living with for a long time.
Mm.
Moreover, he has to live with his emptiness while being fully aware that everyone in the world now knows just what a manufactured lie his image has been.
Mm.
Having stared into this void, having known this hollowness, I can neither excoriate the guy nor exonerate him. I am Tiger Woods. And because of that, I can only hope that he realizes he's sick and takes steps to get better.
I am Tiger Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And we're back at the Pirate Monk podcast. I think that article was just really powerful.
Yeah.
We have so much stuff that I feel like I say all the time here. That was really powerful.
Yeah.
But we're talking about strong emotions and strong holes in people's lives. And
I'd love to know what response Mike is getting from that column. I imagine he got a whole lot more mail from that than from the typical column that he writes. And it's the power of, even though he didn't give detail,
mm-hmm.
it's the power of authenticity
mm-hmm.
and confession.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got the balls to stand up and say, I am Tiger Woods.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. It's a great gift that he's given to his readers to say that.
Mm-hmm. And I think authenticity is probably the hallmark of like real relationships, and
yeah.
real relationships in a lot of ways are the key to fighting off
yeah.
Relapses and just daily
yeah.
Temptation.
Yeah, I'd like us to talk about that today, if we can. I found that a lot of my conversations in the last couple of weeks with guys have centered around the subject of relapse prevention. You know, what do we do to keep from going back into the belly of the beast?
Yeah, and I think, first of all, it's important to recognize what it's not. It really isn't this thing of, like, controlling the behavior. Like, going, we don't want to just not do it because... don't do it because I say so, or because the behavior is not the we do want to modify the behavior, but we don't. That's not the exactly the problem, you know.
Exactly. I remember one of the key turning points for me in recovery was when an early sponsor said, "Sex is not your problem. Your biggest problem is you think that sex is your problem. Sex is not your problem. Sex is just your favorite solution. It's the medication you use to." Numb the pain caused by your real problems, which are common to man.
Mm.
It's real easy for us to focus on the behavior, try to control the behavior. I tried for a couple of decades to control the behavior and could never succeed.
Mm.
And it took me a long time to understand it's because I was starting in the wrong place. We got to really back up. This thing's not about the behavior.
Yeah.
For me, a big part of it, David, is that I think any addiction begins as a desire, a felt need to escape my real life. For some reason, there's something about my life that's unacceptable. I've got to escape. I've got to go somewhere. Sometimes that thing is a real trauma. Some addictions begin as a kind of a life-saving effort to escape deep trauma.
Right.
And sex addiction usually is rooted in a trauma of some kind. But I think we also have an enemy who exaggerates the negative.
Right. Because if that were true about all sex addiction, I mean, right now, porn is an epidemic
right.
in our country, and that would mean... like, you know, 4 out of 6 men had some deep trauma in their life, and I just don't think that's probably true. So he exaggerates the negative thing that happened.
And then this guy, that's let's personify evil. I think we can personify evil.
Okay.
Bible certainly does.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that this guy is so cagey that he can even convince us that the Garden of Eden is bad.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Because he'll get us to focus on the one thing that we're not allowed to do and then convince us that that ruins our entire life.
Mm-hmm.
So a big part of recovery is learning to live in the world of what is. I found out when I got in recovery, I had to be taught how to live. I didn't know how to live in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
I had run from my life for so long into fantasy, and then into sexual fantasy, and, you know, running this double life.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to operate in the real world.
And so part of that for you was I don't know, finding your tree of good and evil, knowledge of the good and evil, figuring out what that was, this thing that you would choose to focus on?
Yeah, yeah. I think I had this feeling that I ran from negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid of anger. I was mm-hmm. afraid of sadness. I was mm-hmm. afraid of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I medicated all of those, just ran from them.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of recovery is learning that I'm not going to die if I'm sad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to die if I'm afraid. I'm not going to die if I'm angry. And I need to learn to say those things out loud to God and other people. And learn to sit in it. M. Scott Peck, in that great book of his, The Road Less Traveled,
right.
I think it might be the second best-selling book of all time. 250 consecutive weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Mm. The guy was a believer, remarkable guy. Opened his book this way. He says, "Life is difficult. This is a great truth. One of the greatest truths. It's a great truth because once we truly see this truth, we transcend it.
Mm.
Once we truly know that life is difficult, once we truly understand and accept it, then life is no longer difficult. Because once it is accepted, the fact that life is difficult no longer matters."
Mm. Why do you think that is? I mean, it sounds pithy and all that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there was always this voice in my head that said, good isn't good enough.
Mm.
Only perfect is good.
Mm.
We're back to that topic that you and I discussed in the very first broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
How God, during the stages of creation, said all the way, you know, even while there's still all kinds of chaos and darkness, and kept saying, it's good and resting.
Mm.
So the work that God has begun in me is not complete, but it is good.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And my marriage is not perfect, but my marriage is good. My wife is not perfect, but my wife is good.
Right.
My life is difficult, but my life is good.
Mm-hmm.
What the enemy does is he always is telling me what's wrong and trying to get me to focus on that, which is why one of the most powerful tools in recovery, something I was taught early on, is the power of the gratitude list.
Mm, that is really true. Yeah.
I can remember, one time jonesing so bad to use,
mm-hmm.
and I had money in my pocket. There was a whorehouse down the street, and I just, and that was between where I was and home. And there was just no way I was going to get home successfully, right?
Mm-hmm.
And feeling the craving. There's just no way, and calling my sponsor, you know, in desperation. What am I going to do? And he said, sit down, take out a piece of paper. I want you to fill that piece of paper with things that you are grateful for.
Mm-hmm.
And it was phenomenal, writing out that gratitude list. It was phenomenal to feel the craving subside.
Mm.
Paul says in Romans chapter 1, when he describes man's descent into depravity, that it began when man did not honor God as God and was not grateful. Mm. Then God gave him over to a reprobate lust.
Mm. Yeah, and that's the thing that you continue to do. Not something that you, it's not a one-time thing or a fix-it for a thing, but it's something I know from personal experience, continue to do
right.
as a discipline.
Right. Continue to write that gratitude list.
To the point where, personally, myself, you know, I've gotten to the point where I'm actually, in some ways, grateful for the struggle
yeah.
that I have because it has made me more aware that I'm a sinner
yeah.
for real.
Yeah.
Not some intellectual idea of a sinner. I am a sinner.
Yeah.
You know? And I need grace and I need mercy. And therefore Jesus takes his proper spot as a savior. If I don't really think I sin, I don't really need a savior.
Right. Yeah.
So
and for me, that's why I'm now grateful for my addiction.
Mm.
Boy, is it you know, deepened my faith and brought me more into reality. It's forced me to face the limits of my humanity and mortality, the fact that I can't occupy the center of the universe. I'm not God. Mm-hmm. I can't run my life, let alone yours. But when I resign from that job and let God be God, I find that I'm grateful for whatever forces me to tender my resignation. And for me, that's an addiction that God has seen fit not to remove from me.
You know, take Saint Nate down and put Jesus back where he belongs.
That's
because,
it.
You know, as May was saying, what is his first name?
Gerald May.
Gerald May.
In Addiction MD. And Grace. Yeah.
MD. When he talks about that we are so broken.
Yeah.
We don't even realize how broken. And after 30 years of working with addicts, being able to neurologically prove that you have actually broken down the means to deal with your fears, anger, and sadness in the right way, and it just echoes that stuff that Paul says about, you know, it's no longer me doing those things, but it is sin that is alive in my members that is doing it. And when you're broke that bad, you need a supernatural makeover, because there's nothing else that's going to change it. And it's like, unfortunately, people think of the supernatural as like an atomic bomb dropping down and everything changes, but it really looks like the mundane, the everyday.
Yeah.
The miracle of the everyday is something that people need to really grasp.
And it's transformation brought about by incremental change.
Mm-hmm.
And it begins with surrender. It's the amazing thing. I get sober by giving up and surrendering, and I stop doing. I have to be, you know, one of the pirates who don't do anything to get sober.
Right.
And then to stay sober, to prevent relapse, I've got to learn to live a different way. And it does require some action on my part. That was a big disappointment to me, by the way.
That you couldn't fix yourself?
No, it was a big disappointment. I thought that surrender was the whole key.
Oh.
So I surrendered, got sober, and, you know, for the first time in my life, you know, had some extended freedom from the behavior, from the obsession. I mean, the world changed, and I thought, you know,
I whipped this puppy.
This is awesome. As long as I just never do anything again, I'll, you know. You know, but eventually it returned, and I had to start to learn to do things. What we in the Samson Society call the daily disciplines.
Mm.
It actually had to begin before that. It had to begin with deepening a real relationship with another person.
Mm.
I think that's the first step. You know, we say in the path, the first step is I start coming to meetings,
mm-hmm.
and the meetings are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of guys start coming to meetings. They experience this change, life change, and then they start to think, hey, I can stay sober by going to meetings. It only takes an hour a week, you know, show up.
Just like Ocala Mike was saying, that the people had made the end all be the meeting, and that's the magic pill, the silver bullet.
Yeah. Meetings are wonderful, but they're just a portal into the fellowship, and that's the place where I can meet the guys who are going to carry my casket, you know, that team of men who I'm going to walk through life with. And there's always going to be a lead guy. That guy is going to be my Silas.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to have a daily relationship with another guy. I need to live in my life, to accept the reality of my life on a daily basis, to see it and to accept it and to carry it. I need help.
Mm-hmm.
I got to be able to speak it out loud to another person.
Yeah, so much of that is just live between your ears, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I prefer a private solution. I'd like to be sober and isolated. I found out I can't.
That's exactly right.
I cannot. I have to stay in relationship, and it's got to be an authentic relationship. I can't be bull. I apologize for saying. In a recorded thing, yes, the bad word. So, I'm trying to turn over a new leaf. I kind of got, I think, a reputation as the cussing guy. It was an important part for me of becoming authentic. It's a whole different
because you were editing, and if you could just say it and get it out, and just say it like you were thinking it in your head, that was really important for you to like come with the real stuff.
Yeah, because the crazy thing was all the years when I was just totally insane in my behavior.
Yeah, your language is impeccable.
It was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't even say screw when I was screwing around. Mm. So I had to learn to kind of bring my language more in line with my behavior.
Okay, well, we'll forgive you for that one, but don't drop any more in here.
Okay, I'll try not to. So what I'm saying is that relationship has got to be real, which means I got to be telling the truth. I got to drop the baloney, the bull. I've got to say the uncomfortable truth. And then there is some private work to do. The daily disciplines of prayer, study, and self-examination. We probably ought to talk about those a little bit.
All those disciplines are so important for us. You know, you've fallen into some addiction. You've made some kind of encounter at a meeting. You've entered through the portals. You've gotten some clarity. You've gotten some living in reality experience. You're feeling good, clean, and sober. And it may be 3, 6, 9, 12 months, and all of a sudden you come out of what, for our listeners, Nate calls the pink cloud.
Yeah.
And now this is your life.
Right.
And the same things that pushed you, moved you toward the behavior are back.
Right.
And you have to deal with them.
Gotta learn.
And if you don't, you will relapse.
Right,
if
exactly.
If you don't learn to deal with these things and live in the real world and not in a video game world, you will relapse.
Yes, you will. Or you will be the most miserable person on the planet.
Right.
Miserable and miserable to be with. The only person more miserable than a drunk is a dry drunk.
Right.
So it's important. I think living sober... learning to live sober is like learning to ride a bicycle. If you just focus on not tipping over, you're going to tip over. Because in sobriety, as in riding a bicycle, balance is maintained primarily by forward momentum.
Yeah, positive movement.
So you just got to learn to pedal. And the question is, what do you do? What's one step after another?
Well, real quick, before we jump there, can you talk just a little bit about like why is that person miserable? They're miserable because the dry drunk. They're miserable because...
Well, if all they're doing is focusing on the behavior, then they've compressed sin to a very tiny part of the spectrum. The only part of sin they recognize is that behavior that they're trying to avoid.
Okay.
They're still in a lot of pain. Because they haven't changed anything.
Right, and they haven't really, they aren't dealing with the pain.
They're probably still egomaniacal. Mm-hmm. If I can actually control my behavior, I'm going to be an even bigger egomaniac than I was as an active addict.
Mm.
I'm probably going to be very condemning of other people who have not conquered the behavior.
Right.
I'm going to be blind to the other addictions that I adopt to compensate for the medication I'm missing.
So picking up...
I'll probably pick up maybe a respectable one. I might become a workaholic. I might become a religion addict. You know, those religious people who are hyper-religious to the point of delusional.
Because they have overcome some insane past.
Right.
Yeah.
But they're super spiritual, not in touch with the real world, really not much help in society.
Right.
And they just leave chaos behind them.
And we're not talking about the for real... deal like holy folk but these people who just really have no root in reality either.
The question is, if I want to know whether my spirituality is healthy enough, look behind me at my wake. What am I leaving behind me?
Mm-hmm. Disciples or dead people.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a painful thing just to focus on the behavior.
Right.
And whether I succeed or fail at controlling behavior, if I'm not dealing with sin and its consequences and its ramifications throughout my entire life, if my if my recovery doesn't have a broad approach.
Right. So you're dealing with the anger, you're dealing with the fear, you're dealing with the sadness, and the joy sometimes, you know, all those things, how they wrap together, the things that make you, and move you and shape you, learning to deal with those. And one of those ways, there's predominantly three ways, you say.
Prayer, study, and self-examination is what we call the daily disciplines in the Samson Society. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, learning to pray, learning to make and maintain conscious contact with God on a daily basis.
People are going to gloss over that one, by the way. They're just going to roll on to the next subject.
Yeah.
I wish they wouldn't.
Yeah.
I just really wish they would. It's so easy to gloss over prayer because nobody really has good teaching on it. Nobody really.
It's rare and it's difficult to talk to an invisible person.
That's
right. Let's be honest about it.
If I could recommend a great book, another Franklinite from many years ago, from the Antebellum and Civil War times, E.M. Bounds, and the book is just simply called Prayer, and
classic,
and it really is just so earthy. And has really been good for me. So.
Good. Yeah, and for me, I found that I need to have some regularity in my prayer life. So, and the best, if I can just remind myself to speak to God before I lay my head down at night and ask Him to help me to speak to Him, to remember to speak to Him first when I get up in the morning.
Mm.
Those two are absolutely crucial. And then, if I can find any kind of benchmarks throughout the day, without becoming, you know, I don't have to become a Muslim about it. I don't have to carry a prayer mat and, you know, face Mecca five times a day. But remembering that there is a power greater than me, and that He loves me and is present with me. He's an ever-present help in time of trouble.
God is real and the gospel is true.
Yeah.
So therefore, we got to recognize that there is that person that you surrender to.
Yeah.
And the reason that it's important before you go to bed.
Yeah.
And the reason that's important when you wake up is right away you're reminded that your life is a spiritual life. You are living in a kingdom within a kingdom.
Yeah,
you're living in what Augustine calls the city of God.
Yeah,
and it's the city of God is inside of the city of man, and it's going to be out there. And you need to get the thing, just like the mind, right at the beginning. And I'm not saying like you're saying. I'm not saying do the ritual.
Right.
I'm saying remind yourself that it's not what we think it is.
Yeah.
You know.
And then it's important to set aside a little time for study. Here's the crazy thing.
Mm-hmm.
I devoted countless thousands of hours to my addiction.
Mm-hmm.
A big part of every day as an active addict was devoted to my destructive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, when it comes to recovery, I suddenly become time conscious. You know?
Yes, where did it all go?
No, but it's like recovery is going to take so much time. I'll tell you what, recovery takes a whole lot less time
than your addiction,
than active addiction. Yeah. But it takes some. So if I could look at porn for an hour or two a day, I can read the Bible for 10 minutes.
Oh, I think so. Yeah.
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 So setting up a time to do some Bible study. Or Bible, some reading and meditation, as you said so well.
Right.
And I find it's aided for me by some good inspirational reading or recovery reading.
Right. Taking from the best that's been thought and written down by the best minds that have lived is one of the best ways to keep to measure your own progress and that sort of thing. And some of those books that we've recommended are Sacred Marriage,
mm-hmm.
Discipline and Grace,
mm-hmm.
Addiction and Grace, and then today, Prayer by E.M. Bounds. So those are books certainly that we would recommend along the way, and those are things that you can think about. And as you read and you ponder, that's the thing, isn't it? Be still, just be still for a minute. Yeah. Would you just stop?
Yeah.
Golly, you drive me nuts. It's like, that's how I would feel, like, you know how the kids are in the car, you know, when they've got something and they just can't let it go.
Yeah.
And they're just, like, obsessing over it in the back, and the one's trying to take it from the other. And I have great kids, but they do that same thing. And you're just, could you please give it a break? Give it a rest. Be still.
Yeah.
Be still.
Yeah.
Be still and know that I'm God. And really the only way to know that, to do that, is to do it. Yeah. You know, sometimes the only way to do something is to, like, I am going to do this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then, so it's prayer, it's study, and it's self-examination. Mm-hmm. Which, paradoxically, I cannot do all by myself.
Mm.
I mean, I do have to look at my life. I'm more familiar with it than anybody else, although my perspective on it is skewed.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to submit what I see to those I trust.
Mm.
And it's just super important for me to learn how to take inventory and then not go into despair over all that still needs to be done.
Now, there are a lot of people that are listening, and they hear you say self-examination, and they're thinking, okay, I'm a pretty good guy, I'm a husband, I have this problem, I sin a lot. Or they're thinking, like, way on the other side of the spectrum, I'm a terrible person, I'm a terrible husband, I'm a terrible father, I'm a terrible friend, all these things, which all may be true, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really what we're talking about. Like, talk a little bit about how the ruthlessness of what you're talking about.
Yeah, in the world of 12-step recovery, they call it suddenly my memory deserted me, a fearless moral inventory.
There you go. That's perfect. Yes.
Yeah.
That's
what
I mean.
Yeah, which means looking at both sides of the ledger. I've got to be able to tally my assets as well as my liabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's strictly for informational purposes. It's so that I can make sound decisions. I've got to know what I have, what I'm working with.
Mm.
I've got to stop deluding myself about where I really am. And so it really helps to do this with the aid of another person who can suggest things to count.
Mm.
So your silence can say, between now and next week,
right,
make a list of fears. What are you afraid of?
And then give you an example, like in my own personal one,
right?
I said, you know,
that's right, exactly, you know,
cats and small gerbils. I don't know, you know what I mean? Whatever you're afraid of. I mean, the things that you're really afraid of. I mean, from the mundane things. I mean, this is kind of really everyday things too. Like, I'm afraid of dying alone in a nursing home with nobody to come see me ever again.
Yeah. You know? And to do all of this, I mean, I don't think we can do self-exam. And it's developing this confessional lifestyle.
Mm.
Grace is only available to me in the to the degree in which I'm willing to admit that I need it.
Right.
And so, learning to confess every day to God and to another person. To Christ and to the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how healing comes. That's what James says.
Mm-hmm.
Confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. Mm-hmm. You don't get the healing without the confession.
Right.
And it's an ongoing thing. I'm going to be confessing till the day I die.
Right.
I hope. I mean, I hope I believe the gospel enough. I hope I'm courageous enough. I hope I'm in touch enough with my own need of grace that I can continue to confess.
Right, right. So the things that you will give to another person to carry, those things the Lord will help you with and give you grace and sustenance to carry it. The things that you choose to hide are the things that you think you can fix yourself, or they're just too brutal to be known. They're going to brutalize you.
Yes.
So you would say then that the best course for avoiding relapse or coming out of relapse, if you do have a relapse, And by the way, relapse is fairly common. If you, if any of you watch the show Intervention, you'll see usually that people, even the success stories, they'll say after a brief relapse, so and so has been sober since 2007.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And that's encouraging to me.
Yeah, relapse is a big part of my story. When I bring new guys in, when I had that first meeting with guys, you know, I tell them that relapse is optional, and that if they'll get humble quick, get honest quick, stay honest, do what I tell them to do, they never have to relapse again.
Mm.
And there is a small percentage of guys
mm.
who listen, take it to heart, do it, and, you know, they call me a year later. I get these calls. I love getting these calls.
Mm.
Nate, I just want you to know, thank you for that conversation we had a year ago. I'm sober a year today. I wish that were my story, but I was too
pig-headed,
too arrogant. But relapse isn't fatal, and we can learn to live in a way where relapse isn't necessary.
I walk this road so very long ago to show the way so you would know. I walk the road with holes in my hands and feet to make the way. Come follow me. No, you are not alone. You will be free indeed. The journey starts with a step or two. What are you waiting for? I'm waiting for you.
That song, didn't you, David?
I wrote that song.
Nice, nice.
I wrote it. I mean, little bit of a self-aggrandizement here.
Hey, if you can't play, you can't play your stuff on your own podcast, where can you play it?
Right. And welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. You're here with David Mullen, Nate Larkin, and I think a really good way for people to get into the things that we were talking about earlier is to go to the website, SamsonSociety.org, and check out the documents there. There's plenty of stuff for you to download that will take you through some of these steps. The actual package for 48 Hours of Frankness has a lot of these steps for the prayer, study, and ruthless self-examination, a fearless moral inventory, if you will. And we would just highly, again, recommend, along with Ocala Mike, that you get into soon, get into the mode to plan your own 48 Hours of Frankness, because those retreats many times will open up the relationships that move beyond the meeting. And the meeting after the meeting is the meeting. The meeting after the meeting is the meeting. It's the after party. It's where the work goes down. So those relationships, you have got to develop relationships or you will relapse. And that's the bottom line. So if you don't want to, I would suggest highly that you move into those things. You know, the 48 Hours of Frankness that's in California.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard from Joe Perry and Dave Mayfield. They're almost full already.
Yeah, I heard like 50.
I think there's 50
guys. What's the capacity on that?
Well, we thought capacity was 60. We might be able to push it to 70, but we'll have to pay some more money, get some bigger facilities to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
The guys had to jack the price a little bit. But only that's going to be a great weekend. I'm going to be there. You're going to be there.
I'm going to be there, yep.
And Creston, California, January 29, 30, and 31.
And they can find links for that.
On the website, SamsonSociety.org.
Great. And so the 48 Hours of Frankness in California, and then I think there was one other thing I wanted to talk about. Oh, yes, the fall. We're talking about taking some of this on the road and doing some work with college students, trying to really, we know that young men are dealing with this, and in the last podcast we had talked with Scott about reaching some of the adolescent-aged boys with the message of brotherhood early on. And once again, a really good place to catch folk is in college, because they're starting to make their own decisions, and there's sort of a delineation there, a demarcation where they need that new encouragement, you know, and so we're working with several universities to come and speak to, you know, BCMs and FCAs and that sort of thing. And if your college or your university has some sort of interest in that, or you'd like to suggest an area of the country that we come to, please send us a letter at letters@SamsonSociety.org. If you have any questions or any comments, anything you want us to discuss on the show, a suggestion for a guest, or you just want to say hi, write us at letters@SamsonSociety.org.
Don't give up on me.